Welcome to Ruby Ray, real and raw conversations for the rising global woman. I am your host, Jacqueline Norton. Welcome back to another episode of the Ruby Ray podcast. I am your host, Jacqueline Norton. Before we move any further, I just have to level with you for a minute here. I am so sorry. I made a huge mistake that has now been corrected. But basically, when I was recording this episode, at the very end, the tracks slipped. So they got disorganized. They got put off, and in this episode with Brianna Weist, it sounds like I'm interrupting her the whole time and we're speaking over each other. And it's so funny because when I was doing the final edits on it, it's like I saw that happen out of the corner of my eye, but I didn't go back and check it, or I didn't think anything more of it really until I saw the reviews of people having like horrible listening experiences from this episode. So I get it. I am so sorry. I'm so sorry to everyone who had to listen to that episode. And I know how amazing Brianna is, and her information, her wisdom is just so rich. And so I'm really, really sorry to anyone who had to sit through that horrible listening experience. And if you did and you're still here, thank you. I know I can't do anything about the thousands of people that have already listened to it, but it is fixed now. So I just have to level with you for a moment and be really real and really transparent about what happened in my process. And I'm only human, so I make mistakes, and I'm a one-woman show here. So it happens over time, and it's just a part of the process. So I hope you forgive me. It is fixed now. So I just wanted to give this new an updated intro, so anyone new to the podcast, new to the show, knows that this episode has now been fixed, so there isn't the overlapping like there was before. And thank you so much for being here, and thank you for your support. And this really is a valuable episode that is just filled with so much really practical and useful information. We talk about so much in this conversation, but the real essence of it is about how to change your life. And I know that's a really big statement to make. So we break it down into different pieces, like how to change your behavior every single day and changing the way we think about success and money. Brianna covers the most practical way for training your mind and expanding your self-awareness, why judgment and jealousy are two of the most beautiful emotions we have, and the truth about the flow state, and so much more. If you are unfamiliar with Brianna, Brianna Weist is an author and a writer and an editor, and she's written 101 essays that will change the way you think. She's also written The Mountain Is You, Ceremony, Saltwater, This Is How You Heal, and more, and tons of articles that can be found online. So I'm really, really grateful to share this conversation with her. At the end, we had some technical issues. The interview cut out. So just so you know that that's what happened, I just want to be really honest and transparent about this process and everything. And you know, if you can make it through those little tech issues, human imperfections, then this is an interview that I know will really bring you a lot of value and help you move your life forward in ways that are really meaningful and expansive for you. And to me, that's what matters most, is the essence of the conversation and what practical ways it allows us to sparkle ourselves, to transform ourselves, and to come into greater expression of ourselves. So thank you for being here. Thank you for your forgiveness and for your open heart. And if you don't forgive me, then that's okay too. All are welcome here. without further ado, here is Brianna.
The easiest way to explain your work to me, the intuitive response that I had when I first found your writing was, I feel like you would be the person at the party or wherever that I'd just end up talking to until like 2 a.m. about some random topics and just like deep diving into all of these different elements. I feel like your work really brings about the things that we think about but don't always talk about as a society. And I just want to know, did you always have this sense of the wisdom beyond your age, or like an old soul's presence that's coming behind your work and your writing? And I'm wondering what you were like as a little kid, as a little girl, and if you always felt like you had that.
Yeah, well, that's very nice of you, so thank you. I feel like an old soul. I think that I always was. I think that like everyone, I had a lot of maturing to do. You know what I mean? Like an adolescence. Like I think that I acted and thought in ways that were probably very unwise and very not old soul-like. But I think that's just the normal process that everyone goes through. But my mom had said I was an old soul since I was little. And I really do feel that way. And I knew from the time I was really, really young, she tells me this now, and I actually don't remember it, but she says like, you were like really crazed that you had to figure out what you were here to do because it was something and you had to help people. And she said like, when I was like, you know, like 6, 7, 8, that's when it really like kind of kicked into high gear that I was like, Mom, I have to help people. And obviously at that age, I definitely did not know it would be like this, though I think that it kind of revealed itself over time. But I definitely always had a very strong, like a feeling that there was a calling on my life, even though I didn't always know what it was. So then I would kind of like just really like rigorously look up like college courses and look into different like fields of study, because I thought that I could be like an occupational therapist or a teacher, kind of the more traditional ways that people really help others. But I guess what I couldn't have anticipated is that it would just take on a little bit of a different light. So yeah, I think that answers the question.
Yeah. And I know you said that when it came to you writing, it was never something that you were like, oh, I'm going to be a writer one day. And it really came to you, described a moment when you were hiking, and it just sort of came to you that you wanted to move forward with writing and what you would talk about. And I'm curious, how do you continue to get your different ideas for topics for articles? And is it kind of an intuitive thing where it just comes to you?
That's like a few questions in one, but I'll just answer all of them. Yeah, there was like a moment in meditation when I just heard like a very crystal clear intuition to be a writer. So I'd gone to school for something related and I wanted to be in editing, which I do. So I knew I was always kind of interested in that. What I specifically did not know, could never have anticipated, is being a writer like this. Does that make sense? Like this kind of writing, very like psychological, philosophical, I would even say at times like spiritual. I never thought that that is what I would do. So I don't even think I really knew it at that. So at that point, when I really got clear that this is what I was meant to do, I was just kind of learning about meditation for the first time. And I had a journal, and it's in the room with me where I'm sitting right now. And in that journal, I kind of in the middle of that meditation, I just could not get over this like nagging, like gnawing discomfort is what it was, that there was something I had to do and I needed to figure it out. And I was never going to be at peace until I knew what it was. And like, it just clear as day, it was like, you have to be a writer and you have to write about this, like you have to help people. And I remember like at the time being like, is there like anything else I can do? can we pick again? Because I think that I had I think that anyone would have like a lot of reservation about just like putting yourself out there so publicly every day. And I think I felt really insecure and really worried about what people would think, if they would think I'm weird or whatever else. So when I was 20, I graduated from college and I got a job as a full-time writer, and I ended up being an editorial director for that company. So I did kind of do what I had intended to do. But of course, part of that job is writing. And it was definitely my greater strength. And someone taught me something at that time that's like guided my career. And this has been, well, I guess 7 years now. Oh my gosh. And they taught me this: there are an infinite number of things to write about and an infinite number of ways to write about them. And over the years, what I found is that creativity is not this well you tap dry. It is a muscle that strengthens with use. And it was so much harder for me to come up with ideas like at the beginning. Like at the beginning, I would to send one pitch email, I would need to like spend a week on it. Now I can spend like a minute. Do you know what I mean? Like I can it just mm-hmm. flows. But I understand now it's because it's a muscle. It's a muscle that I'm working on every day. So it gets stronger and stronger. It's not like you run out. It's like it actually gets easier and better over time.
So now coming up with ideas, what's the process like for you? Is there even a process or a method to it?
No, it depends on what I'm writing for, but pretty much every day I just wake up and I like know what to write. Well, I like have a backlog basically. So I'll like for, it depends on what I'm writing for, but if it's something that I'm writing like on Medium where I kind of control it myself, I have a backlog of drafts and I'll just come up with the headlines. You know what I mean? I'll sit down and write down a bunch, be like, yeah, that's good. Do that. And then others, I'll just make a list and pitch it. And then whichever get approved, those are the ones I do, but I don't really have to think long about it. It just kind of like, yeah, it's like an intuition, but also just, yeah, it just comes. But, I have a friend also that taught me this, and this is another really important part of it too, which was, I think when you're really connected to what you are supposed to be doing, there is a certain effortlessness to it. Mm. And the work is unearthing it and connecting to that. So that's the really hard work. So the hard work for me was these years. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about legitimately thousands of articles. It's not in any way an exaggeration for individual publications I've written for. I've written thousands just for like one alone. Mm-hmm. So this is like a lot of writing. The beginning, that's the hard part. The hard part is getting myself to sit down and just start. To get rid of those mental blocks, to get out of my own way, to learn the flow. That is where the work comes in. And then when you can connect to that flow, it happens very naturally. And I also know now, if I am having a really hard time with an article or a book, it's not the right book. It's not the right article. It's not right yet. I'm not clear on it yet. Because as soon as I am clear on it, it like materializes. It's not that it's not work. It's that it comes together without me having to like suffer in any way over it. And if it's really not coming together, like it's really like I'm sitting there and my brain's just like racked over it and I just cannot figure it out. It's like, all right, you need to close the computer. You need to step away. And every single time I'm like, oh, well, that's because you need to rethink that idea. That's not, it's like a block that comes. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So what's your process on getting clarity for it?
You just step away from the computer. And you just stop doing it.
Just turning away. Yeah, right? Yeah, simple. Simple thought.
It's not the right piece. It's not the right piece. It has to be reworked. Like, you can stick with that concept, but you need a different headline. You need a different angle. Like, I'm working on finishing a book that I've written literally 3 or 4 times now. And each time I get to the end, I'm like, this is not right. And it's not right because it's so hard for me to work on it. And I'm like, this is not inspiring me. This is not right. But the concept has remained through each version of it. It's just executing it in the right way.
You talk about focusing on smaller habits versus these big audacious plans and how that is the small habits and the small things are. That's the real kind of key to success or to change or to growth. And so what are some of your non-negotiable daily small practices? And additionally, what are ones that you think are being overlooked?
That's a great question. So I'm like pretty much obsessed with this concept because I've found it to be like the most life-changing thing like ever, which is that a lot of these like huge breakthrough moments you need to have. And this applies to your mental and physical health. This applies to your work. This applies to your relationships. It primarily applies to your thoughts and your feelings and how you regulate them, how you process them, how you respond to them, which is you have to work in micro shifts. You have to do these tiny little adjustments and adaptations in your behavior every single day that over time, you literally slowly rewire your comfort zone. To do it on autopilot. And I have also found that when I do it for long enough, there tends to come a tipping point after which it feels unnatural not to do that thing. Like I discovered that I could pretty much train myself to build my comfort zone around what I wanted and needed to do to move my life forward in like a healthy, positive way.
What's like a time frame that you could see that start to happen in from the time that you start doing the micro shifts to it, you realizing it becomes kind of automatic?
It completely depends. It depends on how far away you are from that thing coming like easily to you. Do you know what I mean? Like if it's writing and you've never written before, like it took me years for it to come automatically. Like learning to cook took me, I would say, like a few weeks before I was like so in the routine of it that I like started just realizing I was doing it naturally. So even in some cases, it could be days, but I think you probably need to do something for more than a few days. But you know what, even in those cases, even things that I've wanted to like kind of adopt into my like natural routine, like habituate myself to, I've noticed that like over the years, I've always had an interest or desire. I've dabbled here and there. Do you know what I mean? Like I just think that like anytime you like make one step forward in your life, like you really change everything. And if you keep doing that over and over again, like you get a breakthrough.
So what are the non-negotiable or the daily ones in your life?
It's writing, eating or cooking something that's good for me, spending time outside, reading whatever provokes my interest or that I'm interested in, and always making time to connect with my husband or my friends or doing something socially.
And then what are some micro habits that you think are being overlooked by and would make a drastic change if people embrace them in their life?
So it's hard to answer because it depends on what each individual person's goal is. Do you know what I mean? So like it depends on what the ultimate outcome you want is. But I would say that people are probably overlooking the magnitude of just doing a small thing every single day, like even just drinking a glass of water or, oh, you know what a good one is? It's like working out. There are studies that I cannot cite off the top of my head, so listeners will have to just look them up, where you can do kind of like interval training for, I get what it was, 10 or 12 minutes, and you end up getting the same impact as people who work out in a different way, like for a whole hour. And I actually did that to get myself into exercising. I would go to the gym and I would not really push myself at first. I would just make myself walk in. And like, even if I just worked out for a minute, I'd be like, okay, you're good. You got there. And then I'd be like, okay, you can work out for 10 minutes, but you have to leave after 10 minutes. And I would like psych myself out because at about 10 minutes, you're starting to really get into it. And you're like, oh, I don't want to leave yet. And then over time, it just became like a very like natural thing. But I'd started with these steps that were so small, most people wouldn't even think to take them. I think that most people wouldn't think, oh, if I work out for 1 minute or 5 minutes, it's going to compound on itself. Like you wouldn't think that, or you wouldn't think, well, I can't meditate for 15 minutes. Can you meditate for 30 seconds? Can you just try that? I think that people overlook like how powerful those tiny micro shifts can be.
You recently said that confidence is built from the outside in. And so we're so used to hearing that confidence comes from within. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's a really tricky one because it really doesn't. If someone really hates themselves and hates who they are, and you try to tell them, you know, well, just love yourself, just believe in yourself first. It's impossible. They're not going to do it. And two, they often get worse because like the sheer force of trying to make them feel something that they so truly do not feel is so invalidating that they kind of get angrier and almost like sink deeper into the self-hate. Like it's kind of a crazy thing that happens. So you have to prove to yourself that you are a worthwhile person. You have to prove to yourself that you deserve to be loved. There is no other way. It has to be self-evident to you. You have to go out. If you want to believe that you're worthy of love, you need to go out and find like loving relationships. And then you will prove to yourself, oh yes, I can be in happy relationships. You won't usually think it independently unless you have proof in your life to show you that you can. Or if you go and you take a big leap or risk in your career, or if you go and you really develop a certain skill set. That is how we build confidence. We build confidence by getting out into the world and showing ourselves what we are really capable of, what fears we're capable of overcoming. And then the psychological process to do that is you cannot go from I hate myself to I love myself. You have to inch upward. So it can start with I hate myself. And then the next level you can go to is, are you willing to think maybe one day I am open to possibly not hating myself? Are you willing to get to that place? And you're like, well, yeah, I guess. I guess maybe one day I'm willing to maybe not hate myself. Okay, well, then you can get to that thought. And then once you're at that thought, can you get to, well, I like these one or two things about myself. I hate everything else, but I definitely like these one or two things. And you're like, okay, yeah, I can be there. And then you can get to the next thought, which is, wow, you know what? I feel pretty good about these parts of my life. And then you keep building and building and building until eventually you get to, I really love myself and I accept my faults and my strengths. But it's a process of building and really going out into the world and into your life and showing yourself that you are capable. Ryan Holiday says this really well. He says, I don't need self-belief. I have proof. I have proof that I can do this, and very little else will put your mind at ease.
So when you talk about, like you said, that the quickest way to experience growth is to run towards failure. I don't know if I'm quoting that exactly correct, but it was kind of like the gist of that. Is that an example of proving this to yourself?
I mean, yeah, I think they're really well related. You have to be willing to fail pretty much every single day if you really want to achieve something great. Like, you have to become immune to it. I fail all the time and I've become so comfortable with it. And of course, some things bother me at times, but a little setback 7 years ago would have derailed me in a way that I don't feel that way about it anymore. That loss, that failure, people not believing in you, people saying not nice things about you, people not liking what you do, all of that is inevitable. It is inevitable for you, for me, for everyone. The difference is how we respond. The difference is how we react to it. The difference is whether we let that derail us, we keep charging forward. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, and it makes me think about kind of this, when you talk about self-love and personal growth, and these are things that are super important, but they're also sort of these like buzzwords that are thrown around in just society and everywhere right now. So as an advocate for both, what does it really mean to you? And what's the practice for that?
Self-love and self-growth. You know, what's so funny is people often like will say that, like that I really write about like self-love a lot. I feel like I don't. I feel like I'm more hard on people than anything else. Like, I feel like I try to push people to change more than to just like unconditionally love themselves. Not that that's even the right thing to do. So I am kind of flattered and happy that that's what you would perceive. That's a good thing. So I don't know if I'm so much an advocate for like blind self-love. I'm a really, really strong advocate for self-efficacy, because I think that is what makes or breaks your life. That's radical, complete, 100% responsibility for yourself, your life, and your outcomes, no matter what. How you respond to what's out of your control either makes you a victim or a hero. I think we need more people who see and believe and understand just how powerful they are, just how much they can impact their immediate social circle, their community, and the world, or the world at large, honestly. But more than anything, I want people to understand that they can change their lives. Like, that power is completely within them. And it's an adjustment and it's an adaptation. You have to grow and build over time, but you are responsible for your life. And I really think that the willingness to take that responsibility is the ultimate self-love.
Yeah, I love that. When you talk about mentally training our mind in a way where we're the ones in the driver's seat versus being the passenger. And your recent article was the 31 reminders for when you're feeling like you're not quite enough. And you say in one of them, the untrained mind will always wander to what's potentially wrong. This is something you have to work on and adjust. And that is like, that's it, is are learning how to be the masters of our own mind. So what's your favorite way or most practical way for training your mind and expanding your self-awareness?
Really good question. It's identifying the gap, the very, very tiny gap of time between when a thought coheres in your mind or a feeling comes up in your body and your response to it. Because it's really small, but that's like the fertile breeding ground of your life. That's where you regain control. That's where you regain control of your life. You are never going to stop those negative thoughts. You are probably never going to stop those negative feelings, but how you respond to them determines the outcome. It determines whether they derail you or you simply see them, witness them, validate them, totally see you, totally hear you, and then you literally turn your attention towards something else that's productive. I used to have this fear. I've had quite a few irrational fears in my life. And I used to have this one of like getting shot. And I would just kind of be sitting certain places and I would just have this like thought come up in my head of just like the fear of someone just walking in and just like with a gun. And it would just be this fear that would just come up and come up and come up. And I noticed that it was just like increasing, like it would just come up more and more and more. And I wasn't even like doing anything. And it was really freaking me out to the point that I was so into believing my feelings without question. I thought that I had to be some kind of like oracle, like this. I had to be predicting something. This had to be happening. I didn't understand that I was truly in like a mental cocktail for a breakdown. Not that this gave me a breakdown, but I'm just saying like all of those things are completely wrong. So what was really happening is that I had a weird, negative, scary thought, which everyone has about kind of everything. But this one was kind of even not necessarily irrational, because of course that does happen, but the chances are low. What was happening is that I was allowing myself to get scared by it. And then the more I got scared by it, the more I was reinforcing it. And the way that I actually got over it is that when it came up, I would just smile and be like, okay, Brie, like that's a really crazy thought. And I would just kind of laugh about it. And the more I kind of laughed it off and didn't give it attention, it literally just stopped coming. And it took time, but it literally just stopped coming. And so this is a practice that I've carried with me through so many thoughts, so many fears. When I refuse to give them attention or energy, they kind of go away on their own. And then when they come back up, I know what to do. I know what to do, which is that I don't offer my energy, because where, this is not my quote, but where energy,
or where attention goes, energy flows.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Not my word. That really is true. So instead of, because if you are reacting to everything that's happening around you, you're reacting to every thought and feeling that crosses your mind, you are completely at the whim of, first of all, your monkey brain, and second of all, other people. You are never going to be the master of your own life. You're never going to move forward, and it's not going to happen. You're going to be derailed at every turn. You have to be in a place where things can upset you, bother you. They can make you feel a certain way. Thoughts can come up. Other people can act the way they want. And you still are going to choose what you respond to, and you're going to choose what you do, even in spite of you feeling a certain way. That's really helped me a lot to get through a lot, which is, I know you feel tired. I know that you don't believe in yourself right now. You have to get up and do this anyway. My sister taught me this. She said to me, not feeling like it does not make you incapable. You are just as capable when you feel like it as when you don't. The only difference is your emotion. So you have a choice in that moment, which is, okay, do I need to relax and just not do this right now? And the answer is usually no. The answer is usually, no, I need to get up and do this, because this is what's going to move my life forward. And this is what's healthiest and best for me. So instead of being reactive to everything, thoughts, feelings, other people, you find that gap of time in between when something arises and you react, and you start choosing your reaction.
Yeah. So let's talk about that gap of time in your life right now. Are there certain behaviors or patterns that you're working on finding this gap between and transforming?
Yeah, of course. Your whole life, there's always going to be something. But the one that I've become well acquainted with over the past year or two is as soon as your life starts to kind of go to the next level, or you start having a dream or goal or ambition that's kind of breaks a ceiling, it's bigger than you've ever had before, you are met with so much fear. The next thing that'll come into my mind is always everything that could go wrong, and to the point that it will like paralyze me a bit. And that's what I've been working on, finding the gap between, which is the fear that comes with like being more ambitious.
Yeah. Didn't you recently write about that? Like how you reach the big achievement that you were thinking and wanting and desiring for so long, and then will kind of self-sabotage in a way, or out of fear of actually receiving it. Am I saying that right? Is that kind of
it exactly right? Gay Hendricks calls it your upper limit, which is basically the amount of good things you're accustomed to feeling in your life, or that you will permit. So you're going to try to sabotage it to get back to your place of comfort. I made up a term for it. I call it adjustment shock. Because what I figured out was that anything new, if it is unfamiliar, is going to be uncomfortable, no matter how good it is. I felt guilt for making more money. I felt anxiety for getting things that I'd always dreamed of. And I'm like, what is going on? Why do I feel this way? And what I realized was I'm not used to it yet. It's not yet my comfort zone. And because it's foreign, it's triggering a survival response. And anything that triggers a survival response becomes the enemy. And when you feel that discomfort, you immediately think something must be really, really wrong. And so you start searching. You start searching for what that could be. You start trying to find the thread. And really the only thread is you. The thread is that you are not yet used to your life at this level. And you have to get used to your life at this level. People do this with so many things all of the time. Oh my gosh. It's the core of self-sabotage is to get back to that comfortable place. I want to say that people do it probably most often in relationships. They choose the same type of partner that hurts them in a very, very specific way over and over and over again. With work too, if people have very unconscious and negative beliefs about successful people because they are jealous of them. You listen to the way that someone speaks about someone who is wealthy or self-made or successful or beautiful. The first thing they do is they reach for the thing to humanize them. They come up with the one negative thing, the one thing they maybe don't have going for them. They're like, well, you know, but they're this and that and the other thing. And so over time, if you start even speaking about people that way, you're going to create an association between having kind of a good life and what you really want and being really disliked and being kind of in danger socially. So I think all of that comes up too.
Before we move on to the next topic, I want to see if there's any in this process of learning to deal with accepting your achievements and moving to these next levels in your life, have there been different practices or ways that you have felt or found peace in the process and learned how to stop that, you know, self-sabotaging behavior that just wants to push it away out of self-protection and integrating it into you?
A few things. Just first of all, just time. And that's really that it all really takes to get used to whatever's happening in your life. Just give it a little bit of time to become accustomed to it. And then it just kind of goes back to being normal life and you're happy about it and you're used to it. And the other thing is changing the way that I think about success or achievements or money. Particularly, I shifted from thinking of, which is how most people do, of money as a status differentiator, which I did not like. It makes me uncomfortable and I don't like it. And instead I think about it for what it really is, which is a tool. It is a tool. So how am I going to use this tool to improve my life and the lives of everyone that I can possibly impact? And that makes me feel a lot better about it, because when I can put some kind of purpose or meaning behind this, I feel really like inspired and impassioned and I want to move forward. So giving it time to get used to it, but then also changing your narrative about certain things. That's really it.
And I want to talk about two things that you mentioned, which is judgment and jealousy, because I think they're sort of these intrinsic human things that are a part of us, but they're also like our lower level operating system. So as we move into becoming more accepting, and I really think like acceptance, kind of like radical acceptance of each other and our differences, and no matter where we're at or who we are in our life, these are two things that continue to come up. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on dealing with these emotions internally.
Jealousy and judgment are two of the most beautiful, informative emotions that we experience. They are essential to your personal development and they are gifts. So I'll start with jealousy. Jealousy is amazing because it shows you what you're not letting yourself have. There are so many people in this world that have so much more than any one of us, like astoundingly so. are so much more attractive or successful or whatever it is. And you see them and nothing really triggers you. You're like, wow, they're awesome. And then it kind of just goes. And yet there's probably the people that you feel most jealous of are the people who are kind of close to you, the people you know better than you don't. And they're not the people that have perfect lives, but they are the people who specifically have the exact thing that you want. So when you see someone, if you're single and it's in a relationship, it's not that you actually want to have their significant other. It's that you are literally holding yourself back from maybe dating again or putting yourself out there. Like jealousy shows you what you are not letting yourself have. That is it. Jealousy and judgment are like unconscious responses. And they're also self-defense. So if your friend has a loving relationship, you are scared that you can never have a loving relationship, you're going to cast a judgment on that person saying, well, like it's probably never going to last and, you know, love is bullshit and whatever else you're going to say, because it validates why you don't have it. And judgment is so interesting because so the thing that I always say is you love in others what you love in yourself and you hate in others what you can't see in yourself. And that judgment is pretty much like the cage you've built around yourself. So like when you judge someone else, you are putting up a bar of the cage. You are not going to let yourself do or have or be whatever that is. And sometimes that becomes really, really limiting. It is also a function of we cannot acknowledge that that impulse, that desire, or that level of behavior is in you too. So you see someone who's like really annoying or like really negative. I promise you, if it is something that is driving you totally crazy, like to the point of madness, it is something you do too. You just don't realize it. And the reason you need to pretty much judge that person is you are trying to suppress what's suppressed in you. When you see that person doing it, it triggers something inside of you to want to do it too. That feeling, that thing that they do that you don't think that you do, like you are not acknowledging it. You're suppressing it and you want to do it too. Does this make sense? Like you want to let it out. Like you want to be able to freely be negative and hate people too. And you can't and you won't because you're going to be a better person. So then what are you going to judge that person for? You're like, they're a bad person. It's like, well, that impulse is in you too. And I think that when you can realize that, it really helps you just release that judgment on other people. And also it's very funny to tell people that they hate in others what they can't see in themselves. Because most people just like smile and laugh. And like some will laugh really, really hard. And then some others say very funny things. Like I once had someone in a comment be like, that's such a good point. I think that's really true, but that definitely doesn't apply to me. He was like, I have this friend who is so selfish and I would never be selfish. And I was just like cracking up because I was like, first of all, everyone's selfish at times. Do you know what I mean? Like everyone is that way at one point or another. But most of the time people just kind of like, I know I do. When someone taught me that, they were like, whatever you are really hating in this person, like it's something that you're not reconciling in you. And then when I actually made it a list. It was the self-awareness practice that I recommend. You make a list of all the things that people do that drive you crazy and you hate. And then you write down next to them the way that you do it. Like you'll be like crying/laughing/probably both.
Really what this comes down to is self-awareness and being able to, you know, detect these things in ourselves. So what is this practice? Just writing out all the things that come to mind that you drive you crazy about other people?
Yeah, exactly. Those people are a mirror of you.
I'm curious, our cultural norms. So like you talk about how we've internalized cultural norms as truth. So taking them as objective facts or truth rather than objectively looking at it to see if this is conditioned or real. Some examples of this that you've written about are this idea of being in our 20s and what our 20s are meant for, and this idea that we've all heard of your 20s are to be wasted or to be partying or just these different false narratives that we receive without really kind of objectively looking at. So what do you think is the biggest false narrative of our generation that you see floating around?
Wow, that's a big question. I don't know if I can correctly answer it. There's a few, and then I want to touch back on the 20s thing because that's another topic that I think is so important. Okay, so probably one of the bigger ones is to trust your feelings, to listen to your feelings kind of unconditionally and without ever questioning them. This is why people are so unstable. Your feelings are sensations in your body informed by many different stimuli. They are not a reflection of fact or truth. Your feelings are always valid. They are always something that you are truly experiencing at that moment in time. They are not reflective of reality necessarily. You have to be able to separate how you feel from what's really happening. That's, I mean, the foundation of mental health. So that's a huge one. But the 20s thing, oh my God. There is a book by Meg Jay called The Defining Decade. Every young person needs to read this book. This is the reality. Your 20s are not a throwaway decade. Your 20s are your foundation. There is an astounding amount of research showing that your 20s impacts everything from your love life to your earning potential. What you do in your 20s has an irrevocable impact on the rest of your life. Mastin Kipp says this, these are the years to live as other people won't, so one day you can live as other people can't. These are the years to take yourself seriously, your business, your baggage, your problems from childhood, from growing up. This is the time to address this. This is the time to heal. This is the time. And this is also, this is also the time when your brain is kind of losing the last of its plasticity. Like, this is, you're going through your last neurological growth spurt. Who you become in these years is really who you're going to be. It is so much harder to change people's thoughts, beliefs, feelings, opinions later into life because their brain has stopped developing. So that's a big part of it. But also, over time, we had talked about this before, things become self-evident to you. When you live your life in a certain way and you're surrounded by people who agree with you for, decades, it becomes really hard to introduce a new way of thinking in your 50s. It's not impossible. It is not impossible. It's just harder. In your 20s, you need to be laser focused on who you want to be for the rest of your life. College, enjoy yourself, but like, I took things very seriously, and my husband to this day is like, I wish I had done it like you did, because you figured your stuff out early and now you can kind of enjoy the rest of your life. Whereas everyone else goofed off, graduated, and were kind of like, oh shit, well, not everyone else. There are so many successful people, but you know what I'm saying? Take yourself more seriously, young, figure it out now, because it really, really has a bigger impact than you realize.
Yeah, well, and I think also this is like where personal growth comes in as well, is in carving out the time and space for self-reflection and introspection and doing the digger deeping rather than brushing it all aside. But I do also want to note that it's a delicate balance, because while these are the foundational years of our lives, there is also a truth that millennial women are the most burnt out, stressed out, overworked generation as well. So it is like about finding that, it really just comes back to finding that balance, I think, between maintaining like healthy balances in our life and creating the structure and the foundation that we need to move forward in a way that we want our lives to look.
Maybe I want to clarify something. If you are in your 20s, one of those women who is exhausted and burnt out, you are not doing your internal work and growth. You are setting yourself up for a lifetime of that. The point of your growth is not just how far you can get in your career. It's also resolving the issue of why are you doing something that exhausts you and makes you miserable, and how could you possibly rectify that in the future? Do you know what I mean?
Is there any piece of advice that you would give to women of our generation when it comes to creating change and writing our own narratives?
Yeah. Well, you brought up a great point, which is that I think that women in particular feel, and I think it stems from just deep insecurity, the need to be everything. And I think you need to give up on what you don't want. This is such an important piece of the puzzle that almost always gets missed. You are not meant to be everything. Not everything is for you. That is absolutely okay. You need to figure out what you do want your life to be about. For some women, it's not work. And for some men too, oh my gosh. And anyone else that's not in the gender binary.
Right, totally.
We're never going to be happy if you don't understand that's who you are and that's what you want. And you live your life in an office, you know, kind of like climbing the ladder and not understanding why you're so unhappy inside. And I think it's about removing like the social expectations of like what's good and right to pursue. And instead saying, what are my gifts? What are my interests? What are my skills? And what are my values? What do I want to get to the end of my life and be so happy that I spent my years investing in and creating for myself and for others? And I also think we need to expand the way that we think about this beyond just being like attractive or successful. And also like one of my goals and dreams is to have, obviously, like a healthy, happy family. It's something I want to work on every single day. I want to be a great cook. That is genuinely one of my life goals. And to have, you know, my family and friends over and to cook for them and have dinner. Like that is genuinely one of my life goals. And it's nothing I do at work. It's something, do you know what I mean? So it's getting free and clear to know what you really want, not what the world wants for you, not what your parents want for you, not what other people want for you, not what you think you're supposed to be, but what you really want.
And when you talk about in terms of that, you know, it just comes down to really what do I want to do every day? What are the things that I want my day to day to look like? And to you, are there certain things that you found that you want your day-to-day to look like?
Great question. Writing every day. I always say this, if I couldn't do it for work, I would still do it every day. It's the thing that makes me feel most like me. Like when I'm on vacation, like I like can't wait to get back to my laptop. Or if I am on Sunday night, if I have a bunch of tabs open with my stories for the next day, like I go to bed excited. And I would do it even if it couldn't be my career. So I would do that no matter what. Living peacefully and at ease is my number one goal. And a few times, a few people had asked me, you know, like, what's your next big goal? What's your next big dream or ambition? And I had said, like, to be at peace every day. And I think they laughed because I thought I was giving them, like, a throwaway answer. And first of all, I'm absolutely serious. And two, that is the hardest goal there is. Like, you try it. Like, to truly, like, be at peace with whatever I have to do every single day. And to come back to that place where I truly feel in flow, I feel grateful, I feel like I'm on the right track, I appreciate my life, I'm present in it, I'm doing the best I can with what I have and where I'm at, you know, that's what I want to experience every day.
I totally agree. Living peacefully and at ease, I mean, it's so much harder than it sounds.
It is. And the thing is that no matter what you do, what you achieve, where you go, what you get, until you have that, like, it's not going to matter. Do you know what I mean? Because you're never going to enjoy it.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. You're going to come it will come and you're just going to push it away because it doesn't identify with this life that, I don't know, like you think that you've deserved. If you're not intentionally seeking that sense of peace and ease, it won't stick with you. Okay. So do you have practices or ways that in having this intention in your life and in setting it as a thing that you want in your day to day that you've learned have been helpful for you in cultivating it on more of a consistent basis, not just in our morning or in our certain times of day, but throughout the day as well?
Yeah. First of all, keeping my house as clean and as minimal as possible. I have a really hard time. I also work from home and I have a really hard time getting to that place if things are not, like, I need like clean lines, uncluttered spaces. And that's huge for me. Having the house really clean and having just what I need and what I love and nothing more has been absolutely life-changing. I do this with clothes. I do this with everything. Cooking every day. Taking time to like mindfully cook a dinner from scratch. And I don't get to do it every single day, but I really do try because it really, really grounds me and I feel really proud of it. I do little things, which is like when I'm working, I pretty much have nothing around me, but I will like diffuse oils or I'll play like kind of ambient music, and all of that together like really like fuels me and make me feel really calm. Always taking a few minutes to meditate, even if that doesn't mean sitting on a pillow, and just like breathing and just becoming aware of my thoughts and feelings. And then also kind of the bigger things, the harder things, which is not spending time with people who don't energize me and lift me up, and making sure I do spend time with the people who really do that. And also, two things, being really aware of my goals and my progress, that actually brings me peace every day. Like I have a post-it I'm looking at right now on my desktop where I work. And it has a list. It says January 1st, 2019, the list of things that were my goals for January 1st, 2020. And when I feel overwhelmed or, you know, I don't want to keep going, I look up at that list and I'm like, I know what I'm working toward. And that gives me a sense of peace. And I have a piece of paper above that that says, each step forward sets you free. And that helps me so much, which is, you know, for these big goals, they're not going to happen overnight. But every time you step forward, like I feel a little bit lighter. Sorry, this is I'm giving a really long answer, but I actually have more. having long-term things to look forward to, trip or vacation, I just booked yesterday. Well, so I'm going to Italy next month for my wedding anniversary. So I'm so excited about that. And then I booked a trip to Big Sur in October to finish my book.
Cool. Oh, that'll be a great space to write in.
Yeah. Well, that's what I do a lot, which is like, it's mostly done. Then I take a week and I go somewhere by myself and I just finish it. And I'm not going to say anything more about it right now, but I have like a board where I post like my concert tickets or my plane tickets or whatever it is. And it gives me something to like look forward to and to plan for. I can see how some of these things may not seem like, oh, that makes you peaceful, but it really does. It like grounds me. It gives me place and it gives me purpose and it makes me feel at ease. Also one last thing, I swear, and then I'm done. Always plants or fresh flowers in the house, clean linens, things smelling nice, things like
that. Huge. I have Palo Santo burning right now and it's like, it's such a, just, I feel like smells, you know, it's a direct access to our brain. And we forget sometimes just the power of like scent to uplift and change our mood.
I actually don't know a lot about it, but I would love to learn more because I really feel it. Like when I have oils or I sage all the time, it really completely shifts the way I feel. So I totally believe you. I don't know a lot about it, but yeah, that's like a clean space that like is smelling good and I see my goals and there's a plan.
And even just like putting on music is like such a mental shift that happens of just, and that's what I wanted to ask you too, is like if you had any writing music. And
I do actually. It's like a little embarrassing, but I'm going to tell you anyway. So I used to write to nothing. Like I just needed complete silence. I also cannot write like if I drink, I have to be completely sober.
Yeah, isn't that so funny? Like how I feel like all the beat poets, you know, they're all like Bukowski and stuff, like writing about writing drunk.
They're like write drunk and it's sober. Yeah, I've tried. I'm like, maybe a glass of wine would help. It does not. No, everything that comes out of me has to come from this like very clear, pure place of like logic and reason, and like a glass in and like that's, it's gone. So it needs to be super sober. And I used to need to be really quiet. So I'd be like in my really clean apartment, I'd be really quiet and I can like focus on this. But now I actually play this like ambient or piano music. And if I'm writing something like that I want to really feel like it's really the most powerful that it can be, the piano music that I use is almost like a little bit cinematic. Like it's almost a little dramatic. It's like a little and it makes you like, there's no words or anything, but it makes you really feel something. And I have noticed that like, I will really put it on when I'm working on my book, because like what comes out of me, like when that's playing is like, I'm like, wow, I can't believe I got to that place. That's because that it was doing something.
Or a playlist on Spotify, or is it just some?
I don't know if that one's public, but I actually do have a lot of playlists on Spotify. I'm so happy you asked about this, because I have zero followers on any of them, and I like bring it up to my friends like every time I hang out. I'm like, you know, I have like on Spotify. Like, I honestly thought some people would follow. Like I really did. Like I thought they'd be like looking for a cool playlist, yeah. And like they. oh, wow, like, look at this one. And no one did. No one cares.
Well, we'll go give you some love over there.
Thank you. Finally, I have one for cleaning. I have one for cooking. I have one for, like, nostalgia, 2004 to 2009. Like, guys, these are some great playlists.
Put that in the bio. Great, yeah. Great playlist maker.
I put it in the bio everywhere. I'm like, here's my link to Spotify. I have some great playlists.
I definitely do appreciate. I have a lot of respect for well curated playlists. So I will definitely. So you talk about writing, like right when you get up in the morning, and so is that like, do you have a kind of morning routine that's tapped into it, or do you really just kind of roll over and start writing in the morning?
Yeah, so I'm so happy you asked about this because I have such a backwards morning routine, and I wish that years ago someone would have told me that this is like can also work for you. So I'm happy to like say it. So obviously I've read, you know, the productivity experts and what they say really makes for like a great morning, right? So you get up early, you get your exercise in, you set your intentions, you the whole thing. None of that works for me ever. I have to literally wake up and either just start writing or like get a cup of coffee and sit down and start writing. Like I don't even get dressed.
Do you know what you're writing already, or does it, do you just let it flow?
Yeah. No, like I'll know what I'm writing. Like I'll sit down, or sometimes I sit down and write like Instagram posts and it'll just start happening, or I'll answer some emails first, or I'll see, like I usually keep tabs up with like, you know, projects I have to do throughout, I guess I wouldn't call them projects, articles, whatever they are, throughout the like week or month. So I like always have something to do, and I'm very busy days. Like today was actually a very busy day. Like I woke up and I had to just like get started, and I like couldn't stop until like now. So I just have to start. And my most productive days are when I stay in my robe. People always say like, oh, if you work from home, like you should like get dressed, because it'll like I really don't find that to be true. As soon as I'm dressed and like my makeup's on, like I'm ready to go out and talk to people. I'm ready to like live my life. Like I'm ready to live my life. You know what I mean? I'm ready to go out. Like I'm done with this. But when I'm kind of like none of that's happened yet, I can just completely focus on what I'm writing or doing. So I have a completely backwards morning routine. If it's maybe it'll work for someone. If not, follow the actual productivity gurus and do what they say. I also have to work out. I can't do it in the morning. It like zaps my energy and I like have nothing left. The night, it's the last thing I do because it like exhausts me, and then I like take a hot shower and pass out. Yeah.
Yeah, I've been doing that lately, and it's been really nice, especially with these longer days. Do you have like a certain time that you feel like you write best, or like that you aim to start writing by in the morning?
It's the morning. Oh, you meant the time, right? Sorry. It depends. Usually about 9 o'clock is when I'm like at my peak. But you know what another time is? Really relaxing, like later at night, like 9 or 10. It doesn't happen a ton because I usually am like over it by then. But like if I've nothing to do and, you know, after dinner and nothing's going on, if I can just be in like a candlelit room, play some music, and a lot of stuff comes out at that those times too. But I noticed that it's the times when I feel like kind of like cozied in. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Like it's quiet, there's a candle going. If you don't feel like I want to go out and live, like I'm ready to like just like chill out and focus.
Cool. Well, I remember one thing that you said in an interview too, which I thought was so interesting, is talking about flow and about being, it's easy to work hard, it's hard to be in flow, and about how we, in our society, we emphasize the hustle and stuff so much, where it's like, you're going, really, it's about dropping into that flow state. And so if you have any words on, you know, how you drop into flow.
Yeah. Flow is harder because it really like requires you to be vulnerable, and it really requires you to be like in that kind of like life purpose state. Do you know what I'm saying? Like you are in flow, you're not just doing busy work, like you're doing your life's work, like you're doing what you're meant to do. And it's really hard to get to that place. It's hard to even let yourself get to that place because you have to be so vulnerable. I first learned about flow when I was like in high school and I didn't understand it. And the way that I had been taught about it was that you kind of like lose your sense of time, and you know what I mean, like you just kind of like hours escape you, and you almost like lose your surroundings. You become so like beautifully and peacefully immersed in what you're doing, and it's like the most rewarding thing. And the thing that gets me into it that I realized you have to do is it's so much a mind game of that you have to just not let your brain stop you.
that is it for this episode with Brianna Wiest. Thank you so much for listening. If you would like to connect with her, you can find her on Instagram or Twitter at Brianna, B-R-I-A-N-N-A, Wiest, W-I-E-S-T. And you can also find her books online. Most recently, The Mountain Is You. And if you would like to connect with me, you can find me at Jacqueline Norton on Instagram. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Ruby Ray. I am your host, Jacqueline Norton, and I will see you next time.